If you're below the base flood elevation, you're looking at premium hikes of 100%, maybe 1,000%.
Alaskan flood victims may pay a lot more for insurance. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, investigating the massive landslide in Denali National Park.
We do not know at this point that this is related to climate change. However, it is consistent with permafrost degradation that we've seen in other areas in the region.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
A handful of residents on the Kenai Peninsula have been battling surface and groundwater flooding for more than a month. On Tuesday, Borough Mayor Mike Navar issued a disaster declaration for the area just south of Kenai, a quarter mile inland from Cook Inlet. The impacted area is roughly 6,000 acres of mostly swamp and wetlands. Governor Sean Parnell took a brief tour of the damage yesterday while he was in Kenai for unrelated business. Congress is discussing what to do with the Flood Insurance Reform Act, which could cause many flood victims, including some in Alaska, to pay much higher premiums on their flood insurance. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
In 2012, the Flood Insurance Reform Act was passed in order to cut the cost of running the National Flood Insurance Program. It increases premiums and removes subsidies for residents under certain circumstances, including those who have multiple flood claims. There's one very clear reason why Congress felt they had to act.
The National Flood Insurance Program is literally billions of dollars in the hole.
That's Alaska Senator Mark Begich. He chairs the Senate subcommittee that oversees FEMA and says that while the flood insurance program needs to be more solvent, there is a balance to be struck.
We have to figure out how to financially get it sound at the same time, making sure that residents, individual homeowners, and businesses aren't burdened with a huge premium. And our challenge now is, as FEMA is working through this, it's come clearly to our attention that the premiums in some areas, Alaska obviously could be one of them, but across the country are now starting to see that these insurance rates could be pretty extensive.
Senator Begich says that while the law was passed by the legislature, it was up to FEMA to come up with the actual rate structure. The changes in that structure are sending ripples across the country. One Alaskan homeowner who is being affected is Marnie Gunderson, a resident of Talkeetna. She says she looked up what her new premiums could be after being told by the Mat-Su Borough that they were withholding a building permit until the property was raised to the revised flood level. She says what she found on the National Flood Insurance Program website was shocking.
If you're below the base flood elevation, you're looking at premium hikes of 100%, maybe 1,000%, like from, say, the tune of around $1,000 a year to about $10,000 a year.
Marnie Gunderson says that she believes a substantial portion of her neighborhood now lies below the official floodplain, which was amended within the past few years. She's worried not only about higher premiums and mortgage payments, but what a major increase in flood insurance costs could mean for market property values. Selling that property with the knowledge that the buyer could pay thousands of extra dollars a year could be quite difficult.
And I understand the dangers of living in a flood zone, and perhaps that's not wise, but it's not incredibly helpful to put people in a situation where they have to vacate their homes. It could be something, there's perhaps a better solution that could be a little more gradual.
Senator Begich says he agrees and that he and other senators want FEMA to conduct an affordability study. While FEMA is crunching numbers, Senator Begich believes that the rate increases should be held back.
There's debate, even though we're in a close period here, a couple of days, is trying to get a two-year delay on the law that we passed, which was to reform it, so we can get this affordability study. And then from there, we may then have to make changes to the law that we actually passed.
In a time where Congress is embroiled in a number of partisan disputes, Senator Begich believes that the proposal to delay flood insurance reform should still get traction in both parties.
This is one of those items where there's some really good bipartisan support because, floods don't determine if you're a Republican or a Democrat. They just determine if you're in the lowlands.
Senator Bagich plans to hold a meeting of the Senate subcommittee that oversees FEMA in November to hammer out the details, and he hopes they can reach a proposal that will gain unanimous consent. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The landslide that came down on the road into Denali National Park last week has been largely cleared. The slide covered a 200-foot stretch of the road near mile 37 in rock, mud, and vegetation up to 35 feet deep. Park Service spokeswoman Maureen Galtieri says bulldozers finished working the site last night.
All of the debris was moved out of the park roadway, so that will give us a good start in the spring. Definitely need to do some more debris removal then and check for stability. But for now, I think most of the heavy lifting has been done for this fall.
Galtieri says the job was completed just as the temperature began to drop, threatening to freeze up the slide debris. Park geologist Denny Capps is investigating the slide. Capps says a 3 to 4 meter thick mat of permafrost appears to have slid on an underlying layer of clay, movement that may have resulted from warming.
We do not know at this point that this is related to climate change. However, it is consistent with permafrost degradation that we've seen in other areas in the region.
CAP says aerial photos of the slide area show cracks in the slope that may have allowed water to seep in and destabilize the soil. An employee at Denali National Park made a disturbing discovery while driving last week to the site of the landslide on the park road. He saw trash scattered near a turnout at mile 7 and stopped to investigate. What he found has park staff baffled, including Galtieri.
There was evidence that a visitor had a small campfire. So on investigation and looking into it, they found a few boxes from Petco and found that multiple small pets had been, cooked in that campfire.
Galtieri says remains of a snake and rodents were found near the fire, along with a box containing a turtle. The turtle had been exposed to freezing temperatures overnight and was believed to have died. Boxes and a receipt indicated that the animals had been purchased at Petco in Fairbanks. The National Park Service has been working with Petco to try to identify the person who bought the animals, but Galtieri says no leads have turned up yet.
And when you buy pets at a store like Petco, you fill out pet ownership paperwork, and the names on that were all fictitious names. There was some surveillance tape, but very difficult to make out what the individuals like.
Staff at the Fairbanks Petco say they are not authorized to release information since the investigation is ongoing. Galtieri says the National Park Service is conducting an investigation, and anyone with information is encouraged to contact them. There is at least one bright spot in the story, however. Park rangers were able to warm up the freezing turtle and revive it. It now lives with a family in Healy who named it Lucky. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the history of fish traps in Alaska.
Congressman William Sulzer called them the most murderous and iniquitous instrumentalities that were ever devised by the human brain to destroy natural life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
The Alaska Federation of Natives convention that just concluded in Fairbanks had a theme of traditional values this year. Protection became a big component of that. The perennial call to ensure that subsistence rights are not diminished was strong, but even stronger this year was the outpouring of support for young people who opened up with gut-wrenching stories of pain from the fallout of addiction, suicide, and abuse. The kids were from the Tanana 4-H group, and their words were filled with emotion.
I'm here to help those who hurt like I hurt.
Geneva spoke out about molestation.
Male, female, young, old, gay, or straight, we all hurt. No more. I'm not here because I hate my family. I love my family to the moon and back. That's why I'm here. Well, here for the future of my little cousins and my children I'll have in the future. Break the silence. No more violence. It's emotional, mental, or physical. Rape and molestation stops today.
The kids held cards with statements and words that were important to them. Patrick wrote about the connection between drugs, alcohol, and suicide. He'd lost an uncle.
Every time me and my brothers seen him when we were younger, he seemed joyful and happy. He got hurt. He got depressed because of alcohol. The last time I seen him, he was driving away in his buddy's truck. I waved at him, but I didn't know that was the last time I was going to see him. I wanted to give him one last hug, but it was too late now.
Natani started by saying she hates alcohol.
I hate it. I hate it in my family. I hate it in my village.
She told a story that is too common in families suffering from substance abuse. She had to be responsible for others. Rather than playing basketball as she wanted, she stayed home to protect her sisters when her parents were partying.
Something bad happened to me when I was younger, and I didn't want it to happen to them. So I would stay home and send my sisters out to spend the night with friends whenever they were drinking. Sometimes I would wake up to drunk people laughing, or sometimes I would wake up to a zero below house. Nobody wants to feel alone.
Seven young people spoke. The last was a very young girl who urged people to spend time with their children and eat meals together. Adults responded immediately by standing and taking a pledge to protect themselves and their families and stand together to stop suicide in Alaska. And during the resolution process, amendments were offered to strengthen language to combat abuse. To applause, Rob Sanderson from Heidelberg said tribal leaders should not wait for funding from D.C. They should stand up and act.
We cannot keep coming up here year after year, continuing to say that the numbers are rising. We must draw a line in the sand at the local level. People, please, for those of you that live in your communities, call out the people that hurt our women and children. Don't be afraid. Step up to the plate.
PJ Simon from Allakaket said the root cause of problems in rural Alaska is substance abuse.
At the very local level, we need to turn in our bootleggers and the dope peddlers, because we all know who they are. So that takes courage. That's what we need to do to protect our young boys and girls.
Others called for working with rural air carriers to tighten carry-on screening and fish processing companies to prevent contraband arriving with foreign workers. A Fairbanks group has been working for 6 years to restore a biplane that once belonged to Carl Ben Eielson. The plane has a new set of wings, a fresh coat of paint. It's now hanging once more from the ceiling of the Fairbanks Airport Terminal. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Rick Krajowski stands midway up a ladder. He's tightening a cable attached to the bottom side of an airplane wing overhead.
And there's over almost 600 feet of cable in this airplane.
Krajowski is a volunteer with the Farthest North chapter of the Experimental Aircraft Association.
Does that feel good?
Back in 2007, the group took on a project to restore a biplane that once belonged to aviator and explorer Carl Ben Eielson. Krajowski uses pliers to twist at a cable. It's one of many that crisscross between an upper and lower set of wings.
Now, the different wires do different things, but these wings here are going to support the wing in flight. They're the ones coming up from the bottom. The ones coming down from the top hold the wings up when it's sitting on the ground.
This is a Curtiss JN-4D, but people call it a Jenny for short. It came to Fairbanks in 1923 after Ben Eielson convinced a group of businessmen to buy it for $2,400. Eielson flew the first mail flight between Fairbanks and McGrath in 1924. He didn't use this plane for mail delivery, but he did fly the Jenny all over interior Alaska. Roger Wagle is an instructor with the UAF Community and Technical College's Aviation Maintenance Technology Program.
It had enough gas for, what was it, a little over 150 miles, I guess. So it went to Central Circle, I think. Wiseman, I think, or Livingood, for sure. Nenana, and I thought I read, oh, McGrath. So kind of in that circle, that was one tank worth of gas, and then you have to refill up to come back.
The plane itself took a beating. Without runways, it landed on gravel bars. During takeoff, it plowed through alders and other brush. But only a few years after arriving in Fairbanks, the plane was grounded. Angela Lynn is the collections manager for ethnology and history at UAF's Museum of the North. She says no one's quite sure how it ended up in the museum's collection.
Our files indicate that it came to the museum in 1945, and that it was basically in a warehouse with no wings, just the fuselage.
In 1981, a group of Air Force mechanics fit the Jenny with wings from a different kind of biplane before they hung it from the ceiling of Fairbanks International Airport. But it never looked right, so volunteers raised nearly $27,000 to build new ones. Bruce Dunkel is a volunteer with the project.
Yeah, we worked, you know, we built the wings from nothing. They started with a couple of pieces of wood on a table, and then we made the ribs, cut the ribs by hand. Everything's totally by hand. It's amazing. Built from scratch. The disappointing part was putting the skin on, because it's this beautiful structure underneath there, and it's all varnished. It's just gorgeous.
Bright yellow polyester fabric covers the wings. They span more than 46 feet. Originally, they would have been covered in linen fabric. When Ben Eielson flew the Jenny, it was painted dark green. But the fuselage is original, and the original wicker seats and wooden foot pedals rest inside. The propeller is also original. Roger Wagle says he's confident the plane could fly again were it not for a few missing parts.
It's missing a water pump instead of magnetos. But if we had another couple parts, we could run that engine. It's just, they're very hard to get. Almost non-attainable. I found a guy who would loan us the parts if we wanted to actually fly it.
Wagle's convinced this is one of the oldest airplanes in the state. Anyone coming or going from the Golden Heart City can catch a glimpse if they look up. With help from the Department of Transportation and officials at Fairbanks International, the plane hangs once more from the airport ceiling. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Some high temperature records were set in the interior yesterday as the latest Chinook channeled more southerly air across the region. Delta Junction peaked at 62 degrees, a daily record, and the warmest it's ever been there so late in the season. Eielson reached 58, and it got up to 51 in Fairbanks, all records for October 28th. The air is cooling today, and rain showers have given way to snow at higher elevations, where a few inches of accumulation are possible, but precipitation is likely to remain rain on lower terrain in town. National Weather Service Climate Sciences and Services Manager Rick Toman says the late October rain is unusual.
This is the latest in the season that we've ever had both plain rain and no snow on the ground. Of course, there's been rain later in the fall and in the winter when there's snow on the ground, but this is the latest that it's been, if you will, this September-like.
Fairbanks is likely to experience its second snowless Halloween since official snow depth records began being kept locally back in 1930. Toman says the lack of snow is helping keep temperatures above the normal high of 21 and low of 6, but more winter-like conditions are on the horizon.
This is kind of the last big push of deep flow from the south across the mountain ranges and into the interior. It does look like that as we go beyond this week, that a somewhat more normal pattern with weather systems moving along from west to east.
Toman does say there's a chance a storm expected on the west coast later this week could send some more warm air into the interior, but it would be short-lived.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by photographer Brian Adams, with the opening of his exhibit and the release of his new book, I Am Alaskan, An Exploration of Identity, at the Alaska Native Arts Foundation, 5 p.m. Friday, November 1st.
The Providence Health System has stopped conducting nighttime sexual assault exams in Anchorage, citing a shortage of specially trained nurses. The change began October 1st. Prosecutors and advocates say delays can mean lost evidence. It also could mean more trauma for victims who may be told not to shower, change clothes, or eat or drink. Jennifer Meyer with Forensic Nursing Services of Providence says nurses are being recruited with two new hires starting next month. Meyer says Providence hopes the problem will be resolved by February 1st, if not sooner. Anchorage, like other Alaska communities, has committed to a sexual assault response team that involves an advocate, law enforcement, and a nurse. Providence has provided the nurse exam since 2008. Nearly 1 month after the federally run health insurance marketplace launched, just 35 Alaskans have been able to sign up for plans. That's according to the two insurers offering plans on the marketplace, Premiera Alaska and Moda Health. Significant technical problems have plagued the healthcare.gov site since it went live on October 1st. An Obama administration contractor says it hopes to have it working smoothly by the end of November. Premiera Alaska President Jeff Davis says his company had 14 marketplace enrollees as of last Friday, just a trickle compared to what the company was prepared for.
And we expect actually tens of thousands was our projection coming into this. So that kind of pent-up demand we hope will come through, but it's going to be quite a rush at the last minute. And again, we're concerned about the customer service experience that provides and our ability to get ID cards out and just to have it in such a compressed time frame.
Insurer Moda Health was reporting 21 enrollees as of last Wednesday. Enroll Alaska, a group of insurance agents working to sign Alaskans up for Affordable Care Act plans, successfully guided three people through the process before suspending enrollments. Joshua Weinstein, who is a benefits consultant with the group, says the technical problems have been frustrating.
Those challenges have really, impeded our ability to actually land people into the final product, which is quality, affordable health care.
Weinstein says the marketplace isn't correctly calculating the subsidies many Alaskans qualify for to help pay for health insurance. He says Enroll Alaska has gone to the U.S. Health and Human Services Department for answers.
Director Susan Johnson, who's a regional director for Health and Human Services at the federal level, is aware that there's an error, and she's indicated that she's kind of pushing it up the stream to Washington folks, and it's so that they're in the know.
Enroll Alaska hopes to have the subsidy problem fixed soon. Weinstein says the group has a list of 2,000 Alaskans who are interested in finding out more about enrolling in health insurance on the marketplace. Back in the 1950s, Alaska's bid for statehood was spurred in part by a fight over fish traps. The behemoth contraptions were placed at the mouths of salmon streams from Ketchikan to Dillingham, resulting in waste while drastically diminishing the salmon runs. As Ellen Lockyer reports, a new book details the history of the fish traps and their impact on the soon-to-be new state.
Fish traps were the principal, truly the principal public policy issue that was driving the fight for statehood.
That's Alaska's elder statesman, Vic Fisher. He was around to hear the fish trap fight firsthand. He says when the Alaska Constitution came up for a vote, it passed 3-1, while another referendum proposed by the Constitutional Convention on the same ballot to ban fish traps on statehood passed 10-1.
And one reason was that the fish traps were the ultimate symbol of control of Alaska resources by absentee owners.
Nowhere but in Alaska could salmon have inspired such passion. The fish traps were built, owned, and operated mostly by Seattle-based fishing interests. Now James Muscoviac, a Gustavus historian and author, has written a book on salmon traps.
Why would you have a salmon trap? Well, for the first thing is they caught a lot of fish. They were very, very efficient. Some traps in good years caught as many as 1 million fish in a season, and that is a lot.
Alaska Salmon Traps, Their History and Impact on Alaska is a self-published work. Muscoviac says the traps took little maintenance but for a watchman or two, and they cut fishermen out of the equation entirely.
They held fish live, So that when the cannery needed 30,000 fish to operate, they go out to the trap, get 30,000 live fish, take them to the cannery and put them in cans. But also, it avoided the issue of having fishermen involved. You know, boats break down, fishermen go on strike, fishermen get sick, they demand more for their fish, they take their fish elsewhere to sell them. Those were all issues that were involved.
The exclusion of local fishermen enraged Alaskans as much as the waste of the captured salmon, which the cannery owners decided not to can if they didn't need to. Muskoviak's book is filled with photos of the traps and their builders. The design for the fish traps was borrowed from Great Lakes traps built as early as 1870. They were constructed from logs and chicken wire and placed in intertidal areas. The first fish traps in Alaska appeared in Cook Inlet in 1885. The traps funneled salmon into chutes, then into holding bins. But they were built in public waters, and federal officials with the Bureau of Fisheries early on considered them barriers and called for ending their use.
A congressman, William Sulzer, who was the first congressman he claimed to visit Alaska, called them the most murderous and iniquitous instrumentalities that were ever devised by the human brain to destroy natural life.
Ketchikan entrepreneurs came up with the floating fish trap in 1907, which allowed traps to be located in deeper water using floating logs held in place by anchors.
I mean, some of the anchors weighed 9 tons.
By 1926, there were 799 fish traps in the Alaska Territory. It was Howard Ickes, Secretary of the Interior under Franklin D. Roosevelt, who led the effort to get rid of them. He worked with the FBI investigating corruption within the Federal Bureau of Fisheries.
I mean, there was one trap that was called the Commissioner's Trap, and the commissioner had allegedly allowed this trap to be placed in a certain location, and he got a penny of fish for every fish that came through it.
The federal government finally abolished fish traps in public waters in 1959, just before Alaska became a state. Interestingly enough, that rule did not affect Metlakatla, Alaska's sole Indian reservation. Metlakatla used fish traps until 1991. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
What do you dream for your community? Alaska Philanthropy Day celebrates those who share time, expertise, and money to make their dreams for better communities come true, like Gene Kaufman, who has volunteered at 54 nonprofit organizations, including Salvation Army Alaska. Join the celebration on November 7th at the Hotel Captain Cook in Anchorage. Visit afpalaska.afpnet.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Public Media and AFP Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.